This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. After a brief hiatus, Law and Behold returns, now as a monthly segment, but still with the aim of improving constitution literacy among Malaysians. And the series, of course, is done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. So in this episode, we're going to look back at two issues that dominated the headlines in the earlier months of this year. So first, the landmark decision of holding Malaysia Kini in contempt of court for readers' comments and what this decision means for freedom of speech in Malaysia. And secondly, we're going to discuss the issuance of the Emergency Essential Powers No. 2 Ordinance 2021, which makes it a criminal offence to create, publish or disseminate fake news relating to COVID-19 or the proclamation of emergency in the country, or to fail to take down such material upon the government's requests. And joining me to help me explain these two major issues in detail is Datuk Malik Imtiaz Sawa, a constitutional lawyer. Hello Imtiaz, how are you today?
I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for joining me. First show of the year, and I'm glad that you're part of it. So just to get straight to it, let's look at the Malaysia Kini case, which revolved around third-party comments by the news portal's readers on one Malaysia Kini story in particular, right? So what exactly was Malaysia Kini charged for?
Okay. So just to be clear, Malaysia Kini wasn't charged. They were cited for contempt.
Okay.
By the federal court for having published the third-party comments, which were viewed to be scandalous of the judiciary. So they were essentially hauled up before the federal court for what is known as scandalizing contempt. And by that, what I mean is there were publications that the court viewed as being scandalous. Mm-hmm. About the judiciary and had undermined the confidence in the institution and the administration of justice.
Okay, all right. And Malaysia Kini was found guilty pursuant
yes.
to the presumption, right? Under Section 114A of the Evidence Act, Amendment No. 2, 2012, which presumes yeah. Malaysia Kini as the publisher of the impugned comments in question. What does that actually mean?
Okay, so, you know, a while ago, the Evidence Act was amended. This is, you know, going back to 2012. And as you may recall, there was a period where, you know, a lot of people were blogging, and a lot of people were blogging anonymously. And the government at that point felt that, you know, offensive remarks were being made in these blogs or other online publications, and it was difficult to attribute responsibility to whoever that was truly doing it. So in an effort to try and address this, the government moved an amendment to the Act, which essentially said that you could presume any person whose image, name, etc. was on the website in question mm-hmm. As the person who was publishing. And that gave rise to a presumption that was rebuttable. But essentially, that made the job of suing blog owners a bit easier. Mm. So that was the intention. So in the Malaysia Kini case, when the Attorney General moved the application for contempt, his case was grounded on this presumption. He said, look, these comments are on a website that is operated by M. Kini, and therefore M. Kini is the publisher or can be presumed to be the publisher of those comments, and it is for M. Kini now to explain why it should not be treated as such for the purposes of law. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, the court said yes. In fact, both majority and minority judgments accept that 114A applied, in that it gave rise to a presumption. Mm-hmm. But then the majority went on to say that because of that presumption, unless Malaysia Kini could show that it was not responsible for the publication, it would be treated as the publisher. The minority view was different. It said that for the purposes of contempt, there is a need to prove that there was the party who had published it had intended the publication.
Right.
You see?
Yes.
So, and in the context of third-party comments, this became particularly interesting. Because from Malaysia Kini's standpoint and the evidence that was led, comments are uploaded automatically onto the site.
That's right. Yeah.
By way of artificial intelligence. The only thing that Laser Kini has, and this is, from what I understand, quite a usual practice amongst online portals, there was a filter to sieve out inappropriate language, mm-hmm. so profanity and so on. Mm-hmm. That's all. So other than that, comments went up automatically, and according to Malaysia Kini, they would not have known about that comment until and unless it was drawn to their attention. And so they said they had never intended to publish it. Yes, as a matter of, I guess, technical, from a technical standpoint, you could say they had facilitated the publication, which was what the AG was complaining about. Mm-hmm. But they could not be viewed as having intended the publication for the purposes of contempt. Now, you see, what's important is to understand that there's a distinction between primary wrongdoers, in this case, the persons who authored the comments,
yeah.
who clearly intended to publish, and third-party intermediaries, such as Malaysia Kini in this case, who merely provided a platform for the publication of those comments. So ultimately, the majority concluded that, looking at the fact that a presumption had arisen under 114A, Malaysia Kini could not say that it did not know of the publications because it ought to have known, and it could be presumed to have known, by reason of the fact that it was foreseeable that such things could be published. I'll come back to that in a minute. But from the minority standpoint, they said, well, that's not enough to show that there was contempt, because contempt can only be concluded on the basis of actual intention,
that's right.
and not presumed. Mm-hmm. So that's how the majority and the minority decisions split, and how 114A came into play.
Okay. Just reading up about this, I mean, some civil society organizations, for example, CIJ, the Center for Independent Journalism, they raise concerns over what they call the overreach of Section 114A of the Evidence Act, which they say that this decision, you know, to hold Malaysia Kini in contempt of court simply reinforces. Would you agree with that?
I think to some extent I would agree. We must keep in mind that, you know, both the majority and minority took positions on the law. Mm-hmm. And they came to different conclusions on how the law should be applied. So as things stand, the majority judgment represents the decision of the court, mm-hmm. because it was six judges to one. So in as much as we may disagree or with it, I mean, the fact of it is that's the law.
Sure.
So when you talk about an overreach, I can agree that, in my view, the section should not be understood as allowing for the outcome that the majority arrived at. Mm-hmm. Because as it turns out, on the basis of the evidence before the court, ultimately you have a third-party intermediary, like Malaysia Kini, or it could be any other intermediary for that fact, being penalized for matters that it had never participated in the publication of, other than as a platform. So they were being penalized for having allowed for that platform. And in that way, it's a bit worrying, because what you're doing, therefore, what the majority's judgment has done really is to create a liability on persons who might be hosting platforms for discussions, online discussions, and so on, and has gone as far as saying that those persons could be responsible and therefore liable for contempt, even if there was no proof that they had actually intended to publish the statements in question. So that's worrying, and I think would require consideration perhaps by Parliament and government because of the impact on online media and so on.
Yeah. So you represented Malaysia Kini, right? What were some of the arguments presented in Malaysia Kini's defence?
Okay, so in summary, I think what we said was, yes, we accept that the comments were scandalous. There was no question of that. But we said we had no direct involvement in the publication. We were merely third-party intermediaries. We were not the primary authors of those comments. And more importantly, we said that as soon as it was brought to our attention by the police, a call was made, the comments were taken down in a matter of minutes. Now, this is important because many sophisticated jurisdictions, ours as well, employ what is called a takedown policy, For Malaysia, we have the Communications Multimedia Act, which specifically prohibits censorship of the internet. So in line with that, there is a code that has been agreed to by the MCMC, which puts in place a takedown policy. What that code requires is a publisher or a host of such an online platform to take down the offending comments within 48 hours of being notified.
Right.
If you have done that, according to the statute, that is a complete defense. And that was our argument. And you'll see much of what we said reflected in the judgment of the minority. The majority, however, took the view that because there was an overarching need to ensure that scandalous material was not published, and there is a provision in the CMA which makes it an offence to publish scandalous material, but really that's for prosecution by the Attorney General in conjunction with the MCMC. But they said that since that is there, the code should be read as necessarily limiting such material. Therefore, it was not a defence for us to take down within 48 hours. Now, I have a difficulty with that conclusion because it seems to, and I say this with all respect, it seems to have completely undermined the no censorship position of the statute, as well as the use of the purpose and use of the code. And that's left a somewhat unhappy resolution to this matter. One judge saying that no, the code applies, and as long as you comply, that's all that can be said, and the judiciary cannot hold you liable for having not for having acted in a manner that the code required. And the other judges, the majority, taking the view that notwithstanding that you complied with the code, you were still liable for contempt because of the nature of what was published. So I think looking at it now, the only way in which this situation can be addressed is by legislative intervention. Hopefully, our legislators will look at this and think about how best to address it. And I think some MPs and some civil society groups have already started a petition to try and get that outcome.
Yes, because, you know, the ruling has been called a landmark decision, right? I mean, what sort of precedent does this verdict actually set?
Yeah, so, I mean, as we argued during the appeal itself, no other country in the world has had a judgment like this handed down. And when we were arguing it, we did tell the court that this was the first case of its kind, because ordinarily you have contempt where a court order is made for certain material to be taken down and that court order is breached.
Yeah.
That's a very different situation. But as far as we were aware, there was no decision in any part of the world where a court had found a third-party intermediary liable for contempt for having allowed for this publication. The corollary is this. You see Twitter, for example. Twitter could be seen as a third-party intermediary.
That's right.
It merely hosts the platform on which the comment is published. And interestingly enough, there was a recent decision of the Indian Supreme Court, which we in fact pointed out to the bench here. In that decision, the court was confronted with the question of whether a lawyer who had published certain tweets about the Chief Justice had committed contempt, and the court concluded that he had. The second thing the court was asked to consider was whether Twitter was in contempt, and the court said no, because it was merely an intermediary. So that decision actually stands on a somewhat different footing than ours. The majority did address it briefly by saying that the circumstances there were different from those in our case. And I'm a bit uncertain as to what those differences were, because as we all know, Twitter, Facebook would have algorithms employed to ensure that certain types of material deemed to be unacceptable is filtered out. So here we had a filter, and the majority seems to have been troubled by the fact that notwithstanding the use of a filter, we did not take steps to try and filter out language that ultimately made their way into the comments. But as you would know, when you feed in a particular word into a filter, that word is never going to be published again. So if it's profanity, you can understand that that's an acceptable outcome. But let's say here the expression was kangaroo court. And if you fed in kangaroo or court, you would never have had any comments about kangaroos or courts or any other formulation, you know. I mean, so there were these very real practical matters that were confronted by the court. And we, you know, basically took the somewhat extraordinary step of putting in an expert report to explain how their system worked. And no issue was taken with the correctness of that report by the Attorney General. And notwithstanding, the court, the majority did conclude as it did. And Stephen actually did depose an affidavit to say that Mezekini did not know about the comments until it was brought to their attention by the police.
That's right.
The majority felt that there was a need on every single editor working under Stephen to have denied it in specific affidavits. This was despite the AG not having disputed the affirmance made in Stephen's affidavit.
Okay.
So that was another, what I consider to be a bit of a difficulty there. So on the whole, I think what we have to do is look at the majority judgment as the policy dictate of the federal court as things stand, that third-party intermediaries cannot escape liability merely by complying with the takedown policy in the code.
And just one more thing about the verdict, right? The landmark majority 6-1 decision found Mezekini guilty of contempt, but not its chief editor, Stephen Gunn, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
What does that mean? I mean, can you explain that?
Sure. Because in the end, because they relied on the 114A presumption, the majority quite correctly said all that presumption does is to say that Mezekini, or Mezekini rather, which operated the platform, was the publisher. It did not say that. The section did not allow for a presumption that Stephen was the publisher.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So in the end, they said there was no evidence to show liability or culpability on the part of Stephen as the editor, because the company was the operator of the website.
And
that's really what that was about.
Got it. Okay. A lot of people came out to speak out against this judgment. You know, what implication do you think it has on discussions of issues of public interest? I mean, because this was, I mean, what the comments were on topics of public interest, right? And, you know, people were just expressing themselves, I suppose, right? So what implication does this sort of ruling have on that sort of discussion?
I think, unfortunately, the majority decision will have a chilling effect on public discussion on matters of topical interest, because in the upshot, what the majority essentially required was that Mezekini took steps to screen comments before uploading, which then means that operators of websites like this would have to essentially take it upon themselves to decide whether something is safe or not to publish.
Yeah.
And that then sort of undermines the very nature and purpose of online discussions. And the flexibility that medium allows for. It also means that now third-party intermediaries will have to essentially adopt the comments, because when I filter, so let me start again, if I moderate a comment before publication, even as a blog host, when I publish it, I'm actually republishing the comment as mine, because there's active agency on my part in addressing that comment before it's uploaded.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if it's uploaded directly without my intervention, I have no agency in that. So the effect of the judgment is that now, to avoid culpability for contempt, third-party intermediaries will have to scrutinize the comments prior to their being uploaded, or have no comment section at all. Otherwise, they run the risk of facing action. So, I mean, someone did say, look, for example, if Mr. X has a Facebook page and someone leaves a comment on that page, and someone could be doing this maliciously, you know, we have trolls whose job is to actually do this, then through no reason other than not having scrutinized the comment, Mr. X is now liable for contempt. And, you know, you can see that expanding to Facebook, Twitter, and so on and so forth. So that's the worrying effect of this on robust discussions about matters that are in the public interest, because And you know, when, and what is scandalous to one person may not necessarily be scandalous to the next.
Exactly.
And you know, in this case, in Malaysia Kinney's case in particular, the majority view was that Malaysia Kinney should have known that the article, which was nothing more than a Bernama article about something the Chief Justice has said about the opening of the courts during the COVID MCO and so on, in publishing that and republishing that article, Malaysia Kinney should have known that that readers would take advantage of that article as a platform to make spurious comments about other things which related to the administration of justice. So I'm not entirely sure how to deal with that.
It's quite terrifying. Chilling is the word. In the acid is chilling.
It's unfortunate, but there you go.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, it is going to deliver a blow to, you know, the new media landscape, you know, journalists, yes, media owners, right?
Yeah. So I think in part, it also, maybe the majority view doesn't fully take into consideration the nature of the new media landscape and the kind of interactions that happen. Mm. And there may have been an element of conservatism in that judgment. But ultimately, they reasoned it as they saw fit. And as I said, we have to respect the majority's view until a different panel of the court thinks otherwise, if that's going to happen, or until Parliament intervenes through legislation. So I guess in the upshot, what I'm saying is that it really turns on how important the government and Parliament view this issue of free speech.
Okay. All right, so I guess we have to wait for Parliament to reconvene as well to see. And that's actually something that we're going to be talking about after this quick break. I'm speaking today to Datuk Malik Imtiaz Sawa. He is a constitutional lawyer. It's another episode of Law and Behold, and we're discussing two cases now, the Malaysia Kinney contempt of court case. And also after this quick break, we're going to talk about the Emergency Essential Powers No. 2 Ordinance, which just came about not too long ago. Stay tuned to The Bigger Picture, PFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. It's another episode of Law and Behold, and joining me today is Datuk Malik Imtiaz Sawa. He's a constitutional lawyer, and we're tackling two big cases that are kind of was in the headlines of all news. Earlier, before the break, we were talking about Malaysia Kinney being held in contempt of court, but now we're going to look at the quote-unquote fake news ordinance. So, Imtiaz, you know, let's tackle that now, the Emergency Essential Powers No. 2 Ordinance 2021, which zeroes in on claims relating to COVID-19 or the proclamation of emergency. Talk to me about this. You know, what are the various provisions in this law, and what are some highlights of the ordinance?
Right. So the ordinance came into effect on March the 12th. And essentially, this ordinance zeroes in, as you say, on the matter of fake news. So what it does is it makes the publication of fake news an offence. Specifically, it says that it's an offence for a person who publishes this fake news and publishes in the wider sense, creates, offers, prints, distributes, etc. With the purpose or intention of causing fear or alarm, or without such purpose, but publishing despite the fact that it might cause such fear or alarm. So that's really the central point that's being made in this ordinance. And the ordinance goes on to say that, well, if you're convicted of doing that, you get 100,000 or imprisonment of not more than 3 years, or both. And in the case of a continuing offence, it's 100,000 or 1,000 ringgit for every day during the continuation of the offence.
Okay.
And then what the court can also do is to order that the person convicted to apologise to the person affected by the publication. And if you fail to do that, that's an offence, and you can then be fined for 50,000 or subjected to a prison term of 1 year or both. So that's the heart of it. And then what the ordinance does is to then consider various aspects that relate to that. For example, providing financial assistance to publish fake news, that's an offence. Failing to carry out duty to remove the publication of fake news, that's an offence. And then it gives powers to the court as well as to the police to take steps in furtherance of the intention to, or the aim to, stop the publication of fake news. So in a nutshell, that's what it does. The main thing is fake news is defined quite broadly. Mm. And the definition is, if I could just read that out for clarity, fake news includes any news, information, data, and reports which is or are wholly or partly false relating to COVID-19 or the proclamation of emergency in whatever form. Then it goes on to suggest what are the forms the publication can take, for example, visual or audio recordings or in other forms capable of suggesting words or ideas. So that's what fake news is. And according to this ordinance, and it's an offence in the way that I've described to do the things that the ordinance says is an offence.
Okay. And you mentioned all the penalties that can be imposed under this law, right? But can these penalties actually be challenged?
Okay. When you say challenged, I'm not entirely sure what you mean. If the intention is to argue that the penalty should not be imposed,
yes,
then I suppose that goes to question whether you're guilty or not. Then I suppose the other way you could try to argue it is that the penalties are disproportionate or unfairly oppressive. But then the difficulty with emergency legislation is that the federal constitution provides that that legislation can be inconsistent with constitutional guarantees of fair trial and so on and so forth. So essentially the constitution is suspended during an emergency insofar as these things are concerned, and laws that are made in this way can be inconsistent with the constitution. So the difficulty would then be to say you have to benchmark this against this particular protection and that protection has been removed and so on and so forth. So the short answer is I don't think they can be challenged other than by challenging the ordinance itself. Mm. And as we've seen, the courts are not, as things stand, there have been, I think, one challenge has already been dismissed by the High Court to the earlier ordinance, the one that suspends Parliament,
yes.
On the basis that the Constitution contains an ouster of jurisdiction in one of its provisions, meaning that a court cannot entertain any actions to challenge the validity of the ordinance. So it's a question of debate amongst lawyers whether that ouster provision actually has the effect of completely eliminating all challenges. My personal view is that it does not. If you can show that the ordinance was made without basis, then you can challenge it. But as things stand, one High Court has already said that ouster is complete. So as declared so far, mm-hmm. I would say the penalties cannot be challenged.
Okay. All right. And my next question, of course, is what are some of the issues that actually have been raised with regard to this ordinance?
Yeah, so I think the main concern for me would be there are several things here, but one of the main things would be the definition of fake news.
Mm.
Because it's a bit ambiguous. Any news, information, data, and reports which is or are wholly, okay, partly. So which part? How is it partly false relating to COVID-19 or the proclamation of emergency? So COVID-19, there are many, many aspects of the pandemic. Are we talking about treatment? Are we talking about what causes what COVID-19 is, and so on and so forth. When you talk about the proclamation emergency, you've also got several aspects to it. So the definition, unfortunately, is so wide so as to preclude any discussion about these things which could be viewed as being false. And it doesn't say what false means. So if someone made a statement in good faith, yeah, based on data that was available to that person and arrives at an opinion and expresses that opinion, is that fake news?
Mm.
So if you draw the analogy with defamation, opinions, what we call fair comment, are not actionable. I mean, that's a complete defense, unless it was intentionally malicious. So what this definition does is to arguably include matters that could be treated as being comments or opinions. as being fake news, and that's problematic. So if someone were to write an article expounding on a theory underlying what the author concludes is a way to look at things, because the authorities don't agree with that analysis, it could be viewed as being fake news.
So it will boil down to the authorities then to decide, right? That's basically what it is.
Yeah, so there's two steps. One is the decision to charge. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the courts would then try to make sense of all of this to understand what was intended. And the problem there will be the courts will not have the benefit of the fair trial objective yardsticks that we would normally be using in criminal proceedings to look at these things. So you have to look at the words themselves. And because the words are stated in such a wide way, the court will want to give effect to the language that was used. And that could become quite difficult. I mean, the other parts of this provision, which I think, well, this ordinance, which I think are of concern, is the exclusion of the Evidence Act on certain aspects of evidence. So, for example, Section 11 says that a statement by any person who is either dead or who cannot be found or who has become incapable of giving evidence shall be admissible as evidence. So this is a problem because it doesn't say what weight is to be given. It doesn't say that, you know, what do you do about cross-examination? Are you not entitled to try and challenge the statement, etc.?
Yeah.
The way this is stated, it seems to suggest that, you know, the authorities can rely on a statement made by anyone.
Mm.
And then on the basis that that person cannot be found, receive that evidence into the court and use that to further their case that there has been an offence. That's one problem. Then a statement by an accused, whether orally or in writing, at any time shall be admissible in evidence. Now, this seems to suggest that information statements or statements given to investigators, which would normally not be admitted into evidence under the Criminal Procedure Code, could be used. And then you could have, you know, suggestions that there were admissions or confessions and so on. And then the court will have to go into questions of whether this is actually your statement or not. All of these things have really been, in many ways, stopped being a part of the criminal justice system in the ordinary course. And then there's another section which says that they can any document or copy of any document is obtained by a police officer or an authorized officer, that document will be admissible, notwithstanding anything contrary. So we have this thing called documentary hearsay in law.
Mm.
So if someone writes of a fact in a letter, the letter itself will not be sufficient to amount to evidence. You need to bring the person who said it, because otherwise it's hearsay. So let's say a person writes a letter to say, oh, I saw Mr. X put this up on the billboard and he said this, this, this.
Mm-hmm.
Now that document is now admissible and can be given weight. But in the ordinary course, that document will be chucked out because you'd want the person who wrote the letter to come to court and be cross-examined and his version of events challenged. But all that now is essentially eliminated. So what this does is to really make it that much easier for the prosecution to establish their case. Now, in terms of emergency legislation, this is not unusual because we've had similar problems with legislation before this. The one that comes to mind is the Emergency Security Cases Amendments Regulation, ESCA, which was the framework used for the prosecuting of offences under emergency legislation.
Okay.
And there too, there were reversals of burdens, evidence in camera, all sorts of things that the bar had said was really inconsistent with fair trials. See, the problem is this. Even though there is an emergency, the country doesn't stop functioning. And strictly speaking, there's no justification to say that the situation warrants these exceptional sorts of trials. So in the UK, for example, there are special procedures for anti-terror trials. because of the specific nature of those types of offences and the people involved. So you can see a justification for it. Mm. But in this situation, we have laws on the books which deal with defamation or falsehoods. And I would have thought that would be enough already to address the problem. And there was no need for a specific ordinance with extraordinary powers to address it as a matter of fundamental importance. I just fail to see the rationale for this. But it is law because it was gazetted as such, and it has to be complied with until it's revoked. And that would happen ordinarily when the emergency is revoked.
Okay. Are there possibilities that this law could, potentially be abused?
Well, I think the question of whether it will or will not be really depends on the enforcement.
Okay.
But if you ask me whether the way in which the ordinance has been framed, whether it's possible that it could lead to abuse, well, I would say this, that the ambiguities and the lack of a precise definition and so on and so forth are things that could lead to problems. Mm-hmm. And with that, there will be the potential of abuse if somebody wanted to do it. So that's why in law, in the criminal cases especially, the courts have always said there has to be clarity about the charge, there has to be clarity about the offence that you've said to have committed. It must be clear that Parliament intended these things to be offences. If there was any ambiguity, it would favour the accused.
Mm.
But in this case, given that a lot of concessions have been made to the prosecutor insofar as evidence is concerned, I'm not sure whether that would be enough, whether those arguments that we would normally take would be enough to protect persons who are brought to book under this particular ordinance. And also I'm concerned that, the definition of fake news, including as it does discussion or publications about the proclamation of emergency, that's a difficult thing because clearly it's a matter of national importance and topical interest whether or not the emergency was validly proclaimed.
Mm.
So, yes, the Constitution does say you can't challenge the proclamation, and that has to be accepted as such, but related to the proclamation, all these ordinances. So if I were to say, for example, this ordinance is not valid in law, could that be taken as a statement about the proclamation? Mm. It could, or it could not, depending on who's making that decision.
Okay, so let's say we have a post on social media about the government's handling of COVID-19 crisis, right? Can the person who posted it be liable under this emergency ordinance?
Well, I arguably yes, because if you go back to the definition of fake news, what it says is it is false without any definition of what false is, and it pertains to the COVID-19 pandemic, then it could be. So, as I was saying earlier, if I were to write an opinion piece on why I think the handling of the government over COVID-19 is not satisfactory, it's possible for someone to say that the premise of my analysis is erroneous.
Mm.
And on that basis, accuse me of having intentionally published a statement based on an erroneous assumption. And that could arguably take me within the definition.
So, okay. So it sounds like we really have to watch what we're doing. But, in your opinion, does this ordinance actually fall short on of standards under international human rights law?
Well, I think those standards are reflected in the Constitution in Part 2, which preserves protection of life and liberty, equality before the law and so on in due process. The difficulty now is that the Constitution itself does allow for laws to be made that are inconsistent with it. And the thinking is, I think, quite clear. The intention would have been that if you're faced with, say, an emergency situation, communist insurrection, that kind of thing, where the way of life is seriously distorted. We're living in confined areas under heavy guard because there's rebels running around and so on. In that kind of situation, you can understand why it is that you might need to take extraordinary measures.
Yeah.
But there must be some foundation for that. So here we're told that the COVID-19 required this to be done. And so I would think, therefore, that anything pertaining to the pandemic, and more importantly, to the curbing of that pandemic, can legitimately be made the subject of law. But regard must be had to all the other things that are happening in our lives on a daily basis, because as people are saying now, it seems that you can do anything but go to Parliament, because COVID efforts have been successful to the extent that SOPs are bringing the numbers down and so on and so forth. You see big weddings and all these sorts of things.
Yeah.
So ultimately, I think the critical issue is what it means when the Constitution says that ordinances can be inconsistent. And I would think, although it's never been tested, I would think that a proper interpretation of that provision would be that inconsistent to the extent necessary.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just suspend everything and say, I'm entitled to do that because the law says I can.
Yeah.
So there has to be some measure of accountability for that. But, I think all these things that happen give us more reason to consider what actually the law means. And I suppose in an oblique way, we're all maturing and developing a greater understanding of constitutional law that, might aid us in one way or the other.
I remember you saying you hated studying constitutional law, but wow,
yeah.
Look at...
Yeah, I seem to be doing a fair bit of it now, so,
And so much, that is ever-changing, right? So many things that you need to keep considering.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as a constitutional lawyer, I am glad that there's so much to think about. As a citizen, I'm less glad, because sometimes you just want things to get on and get on the way they should be. And let the country move forward. But anyway, there we are.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Datuk Malik Imtiazawa, who is a constitutional lawyer, and he was helping to explain, two major cases that were, dominating the headlines, the Malaysia Kini in contempt of court case and also the fake news ordinance. If you miss any part of today's interview or any previous Law and Behold interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. You can also find it on Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. This has been Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.